when you're at the highest level, the coach is the head of human resources, and not just for the team. The team is one small part of it, but it's the team around the team. It's all the coaches understanding that the decisions need to be based on the athletes and the team, instead of, because they're judged on their corner. So if you want to be the best in your world and you're a sports scientist, then people are going to look at your data from your athletes. Like, have they got fitter, faster, stronger, you know, whatever that motto, where medical, how many soft tissue injuries, so that you're judged in that way. So then you become really, really almost narrow focused and forget why you're there. So everyone is going to have to cut a piece of their pie and lose it, because it's for the athlete.
That's two-time Olympic medalist and three-time Olympian Rian Wilkinson, and this is Difference Makers, a Christina Walker podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back, or welcome to Difference Makers. I'm your host, Christina Walker. It's an exciting day over here today, as three of our men's crews on the national team have been overseas this past week at the Last Chance Qualification Regatta for the Tokyo Olympics this summer, and they have officially qualified today. It is so incredible to watch your teammates have success, and so here's a huge shout out to the men's four, lightweight men's double, and the men's single. Now this week, our guest is Rian Wilkinson, a three-time Olympian, two-time medalist, and the current assistant coach for the GB national soccer team. Throughout our conversation, we touch on the importance of team dynamics and an environment that fosters communication and openness. She talks about her experience at each of the games, as well as what this summer may look like. Before we get going, once again, this podcast is sponsored by Marathon Surfaces, suppliers of rubberized surfacing for walking paths, running tracks, and safety surfacing for playgrounds. Now please welcome Rian Wilkinson. When did you first start playing soccer?
Yeah, some debate in the family, but probably around 6, 7. Oh, wow. Just a local, I think most young Canadians are, you know, get thrown in that sort of house league, intramural, local sport. And that's sort of when I started. Just, I did everything, whatever was available, whatever babysitting my mother could get, you know, just sort of involved in everything, where my twin wasn't. So clearly I was the more annoying one.
Right. Yeah. You're a twin. You are a twin. That's sick. Identical or?
No, thank goodness for her. I mean, she's very different than me. And yeah, so there's always a problem with identical twins. I think with comparison, it's slightly less high occurrence with fraternal, but it still happens a lot. So yeah, she's, you know, green-eyed, blonde hair, about half my size, so she's we're quite different. Yeah.
Did she ever play soccer too or no?
Yeah, she did, and she actually played until she was maybe 18 or 19. And you know, I always think it's one of the better soccer stories, because mine, I had all that encouragement, and I had, you know, you can't see air quotes, but that perceived success. Mm-hmm. Where I was encouraged in it, where she played local grassroots soccer into her late teens. And that's where she went through those stresses, you know, where you lose so many of our young athletes, and was able to do it just for the love of the game. And you know, had some fantastic friends in it. So I'm pretty proud of her for staying with her so long.
And you were just saying that, what was that, perceived interest or encouragement? Was that a positive impact on your soccer like career, or did you think that was actually more of an implication on
what I would say is that comparison is a very dangerous thing. So I learned that young as a twin. It was an important lesson for her and I. She was the smart one, I was the sporty one, which is unfair and untrue in so many ways. I'm not as smart as my sister, but I'm not an idiot, and she might not be as athletic as I am, but she is an athlete. It took a long time to get there. And so when I say perceived support, I mean, you know, I really thrived on it, and sport really gave me a place to thrive, because I wasn't thriving in school, because I wasn't as good as her or my brother. I found myself to be, you know, the fool, the idiot in the family, where it was really just because I kept trying to be as good as she was, it wasn't working. So then I kind of just stopped trying. So I needed my sporting community, because that's where I found value for myself. High school probably.
And at what point do you think you were put in sort of that category, and same with your sister, of the more academic side and for you, the more athletic side?
Oh, I think people do that when you're like 2 or 3 years old. You have a direct comparison. I read a quote, comparison is the thief of joy. And, you know, thankfully I had very strong parents who put people in their place when they started to do that comparison thing. But you do notice when you're young, you just notice, and it starts from very, very young. People say it to your face, oh, you're the sporty one. You know, so it just sort of sinks in. And it took a teacher in high school, I think, to grade 8, maybe, to just ask, like, just because you're not as smart as her doesn't mean you're not smart. And it really was sort of this light bulb moment. And then fortunately, I went on to some pretty great academic successes. And I see those as almost more valuable than my sporting ones, because they really were ones that I, not that I didn't work hard in sport, but my goodness, I had already put myself in a category which was, I wasn't academic. So when I was recognized for my schooling, it meant a lot to me. Same for her, by the way, she's a really good athlete.
Yeah. Wow. And do you think that actually helped, to sort of put yourself when you're in your sport to sort of like take the comparison out of it? Or did you still find, cause like, I find for all athletes, there's always that like comparative or competitiveness, you know, and kind of differentiating between the two of them and focusing on, okay, which one can actually help with my performance. It sounds like you being a twin and going through that experience maybe applied to you then being an athlete where you're not as comparative, but I mean, you'll have to contest to that.
Well, yeah, it was important. I think there were definitely teams that I didn't make. Those pains had an impact on my career, but I think that understanding has made me a better coach, especially to my athletes, because I'll say, like, you know, you're not competing against that person at all. You're competing for a position, but you're different people, you're different players. You need to understand your strengths. And a lot of times coaches look at weaknesses. They really put a lot of effort and time on a player's gaps and their weaknesses. And I definitely feel that those need to be addressed, but just as important as understanding your strengths and making sure that players know them as well. They're not just always having to be told them. So I guess that probably does stem from my upbringing, but most things do, right? The things you've learned in your life and not just soccer, by the way, any sport, any athlete, you spend most of your time comparing yourself to others, and it really takes away the joy of who you are and the gifts that you have.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we see it all the time. And even when you're pursuing something that you love, or even as a hobby, I think it's so easy to just fall into, oh, that person's doing it better than me, or even comparing to your previous self, you know, like, I think that's actually really difficult. And I don't know how often athletes actually take a step back and are like, okay, especially as maybe like a more mature athlete, if they're not hitting certain times that they were 2 years ago, but they have other strengths now, then I think it can be easy to fall back on problems that they faced like a couple of years prior to that moment. And I don't know how you did, if you dealt with those things as like an athlete over your time and how you were able to sort of navigate what to really focus on.
Yeah, it's a big question. I think you're from an individual but team sport. Mm-hmm. Like you're from a very interesting one, because there's individual strengths you've got to have, but you're within a team, but it could be 4, it could be 8, it could be 2, it could be 1. Like it's a very interesting one. Plus you're all meant to be this connected team.
Yeah.
And then I'm from soccer, like hockey, like rugby, where your strengths can kind of morph. So I don't want to pretend that I know like the wattage variation that can happen in rowing or cycling, for example. But in soccer, you know, as I got older, you learn to communicate differently. So you can your leadership becomes very different. You're able to better organize the people around you. So you're not always stuck in a foot race. I was an incredibly fast player, and then I wasn't. I was still fast-ish, but I made sure everyone around me was well positioned, so I wasn't exposed as I got slower, which is just, you'd call it sort of soccer intelligence or sporting IQ, whatever that looks like. But I think a more apt discussion for you and I is these people that have had to come back from injury. you know, when you tear your ACL, you don't stay the same athlete when you come back.
Right.
And I think in most people's minds, you do come back the same athlete and you're always this frustrated. Like, I used to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. You can get just as fast, but your whole mechanism has had to change, mm-hmm. whether you're imbalanced or, you know, whatever it is. And I don't think we spend so much time on that. Like the recognition that it's, you just become slightly different and that's okay. You just have to learn who the new you is. And that's the same thing as you mature. That happens more gradually. So I think you're maybe more able to adapt more gradually with it. But like injuries is something we don't address. Let's say these poor athletes who come back from, I guess for you, it'd be like the rotator cuff or some shoulder injury. And then everyone's expecting the exact same mechanism or the exact same movement, same thing for soccer, where no, you're actually a different athlete now. Mm-hmm. And it's that mental connection with it. It's such a huge topic that I'm not sure we spend enough time really thinking about and really walking our athletes through when they've experienced it.
Did you deal with that as an athlete? And you probably see it quite often as a coach. How do you deal with that as a coach too?
Well, I was fortunate in terms of, it's very rare in the women's game that you come through a career without doing your knees. So I thank my knees every day.
Nice.
I had different kind of major injuries, like torn ligaments off the bone, like nasty injuries, mm-hmm. but not knee. And in that way, so like my speed was never going to recover the same way with a major hamstring injury. So I had the same kind of idea around it, but you know, I think the ACL, it's so prevalent in the women's game because of the latest research is angle from hip to knee, as well as obviously our menstrual cycle and the different times of the month where you're more susceptible. I'm not going to pretend to know the science behind it. All I know is it's very common in the women's game. And we really don't talk about who you are when you come back, because you've been sitting out. There's this, so the psychosocial element of being away from your group when you need them the most, like losing your identity, your body doesn't feel the same. Your knee is, I can't pretend to know what it's like, to have this knee operation, or again, for you, I guess, shoulder for the similarities. I'm not sure, but yeah, I don't think we almost brush it under the carpet. Like, oh, another knee. Mm-hmm. I think it helps me. I try and be a better coach by understanding this part and maybe linking it more to the sports performance, the sports psych, the people that are more educated in that area, because mm-hmm. I'm not.
There's a big role for sports psych, and I've even seen that over my time as an athlete and at different various levels. And I think that there's still a major gap of that sport performance that can become quite an asset from the mental side of things that we don't actually take into consideration as much as we probably should. I'm curious, as a coach, like when we were just talking about wattages, then I was just thinking, yeah, for rowing, like it's hard for us to figure out who's going to be in what boat or who's going to make a boat. But I feel like we do have a little bit more data on individual athletes and for those seats. But as a soccer player, how are those decisions made? How do you make those decisions as a coach? And seeing yourself as an athlete prior to being a coach, did you have coaches where you were like, yeah, this is the way it's got to be? And then you implemented that sort of strategy into being a coach now? Or how was your coaching kind of developed?
Well, sports developed so much. Mm-hmm. It's become very science-based. I think the mental side of the game is still relatively new, and that's where the biggest gains can be found. I would say across all sports, individual, team, whatever level, that's where the biggest differences are in terms of gains that can be made. But the science is something that people really get excited about. Mm-hmm. I see a real value in terms of understanding how it can be used properly. And I think players or athletes like to see a graph where they are, where they need to go. And it's data-based, it's not subjective, mm-hmm. but part of it is subjective. We can't get away from, the fact that in soccer, you're creating a team chemistry. So how many, players can you have on a team who are challenging to the system when in a tournament you're playing every 48 hours, like, and you cannot be spending all your time sort of focused on just trying to get the team to work together. So there is a subjective element that you can't get away from. The biggest thing for me and what I've found in the development of sport is we're so proud of having this like four corner athlete. We've got the mental, the technical, tactical, we've got the cultural, you know, we've got all these, the sports science. And then this in the center is the athlete, but we actually forget the athlete a lot. We get corner selfish. So sports science will believe that is the most important corner, that the rest, the nutrition, the fitness, like everything, no corners cut, you've got to nail it. And then you've got the medical, and they have their idea of what you have to do. You've got to do, you know, 30 minutes of prehab, rehab. You've got to do, you know, whatever the medical taping, I'm making stuff up. You know, the technical tactical will want all that time to be done in meetings and on the field, the cultural, you know, the mental performance that they want the team connecting and spending. So there's I find it very much a challenge now. It's almost a human resource. When you're at the highest level, the coach is the head of human resources, and not just for the team. The team is one small part of it, but it's the team around the team. It's all the coaches understanding that the decisions need to be based on the athletes and the team instead of, because they're judged on their corner. So if you want to be the best in your world and you're a sports scientist, then people are going to look at your data from your athletes, like have they got fitter, faster, stronger, you know, whatever that Olympic model. Where medical, how many soft tissue injuries, so that you're judged in that way. So then you become really, really almost narrow focused and forget why you're there. So everyone is going to have to cut a piece of their pie and lose it because it's for the athlete. But we're not there yet. We lose it a lot. And so that wasn't there when we were young athletes. I know I'm a lot older than you, but before it used to just be probably get in the boat and row. You know, those two Irish dudes who won the Olympic medal, the silver in Rio.
Yeah.
They say it's not complicated. I got in the boat and we pulled like hell or pulled like a dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, soccer used to be 11 players, put the ball in the net. And now it's got all these different elements, and it's so great because it means we can better look after our athletes. We can be better able to extend a career. We can look after injuries and they can return from them, but we almost have overbalance. And it's now just like remembering why we're all at the table. It's for the thing in the middle, not the things on the outside.
Wow. That's a really good point. And very good perspective on your part as a coach to realize that. And, like, how often do you have to sort of remind or have a conversation with other coaches of like, okay, bring it back, you know, because I could see that being like you can get very easily sidetracked. And do you do that by addressing like, what is the common goal? What are your values? What are the team's values? And then going forward?
Yeah, it's really hard because are the team's values the staff values?
Mm-hmm.
Their identity, their, you know, who made those words, those identity words, their values, who created it? Does everyone buy in? Are they new staff? Is it old staff? Do you need to reevaluate them? I mean, that's why mental performance is key really for me, because everyone needs to be pulling the same way. And one different definition of the word ruthless will kill everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I use ruthless as an example, but for one person that's like, everything in, like no stone unturned for another. It's like making the right cuts, you know, from the group. Ruthless for someone else is saying exactly what's on your mind. You're like, no, that's just being an ass. Like there's all different misunderstandings that happen because you're just people,
mm-hmm.
you know, technical, tactical coaches like I am,
mm-hmm.
think we're the boss. Right. Especially for soccer, like we're the head and then the other corners are down here. Well, it's never going to work like that. It's hierarchical. You do need a leader in terms of you need a head coach who's just setting the path and making sure everyone is on it. And then the real like direction, the real push is all those people coming together. And I think that those are the most successful teams. And that's the gift or the art of coaching. Mm-hmm. And the athletes feel it. You feel it when your whole staff is aligned and stepping together and everything's sort of working like clockwork and there's mistakes made. And it's just like, okay, how do we reevaluate? How do we fix it? How do we move on? Like that piece is really critical because athletes are constantly readjusting and working towards improvement and they need to see it in the staff and then everyone back on the same step instead of like you can, they, athletes know about the chatter.
Totally.
If staff are not aligned. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. Did you experience that as an athlete at all? Like where it was like clockwork and everything was moving really smoothly and what were those dynamics like?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have heard the story of our 2012 team, but in 2011, 11 months before we won the first team medal in 80 odd years, we'd come last in the World Cup, like last. And then 11 months later, we won this Olympic medal. And the difference was really, really clear leadership, a lot of hard work on who we were as a team and our ethics and our values and our connection with one another, making it really an X factor. No team would be as connected. And that meant some really hard conversations.
I was going to ask, how did you guys do that?
You had to buy in to a greater vision, to the possibility. I mean, you are in an Olympic training camp right now. And if someone were to say to you, are you going to the Olympics to win a medal? You'll probably say yes. Mm-hmm. But how much do you really believe it?
Yeah.
And that's the athlete that needs to work through that. And we said, we're like, yeah, we're going for a medal. And it took probably 6 months to be like, no, we're going for a medal and to believe it. And then that grew and grew and grew. And it even grew through losses and the positioning of the staff and the conversations we were having. And, you know, when you truly have a vision, a clarity of vision, and everyone is on that same journey, it's to the athlete to decide whether they want to get on or off. Mm-hmm. And we did lose people along the way who just couldn't quite buy into to this journey we were on. But, you know, I remember the coach saying, you want to enjoy every step of it because in 30 years time, you want to run into a teammate on the street and it's like no time has passed. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't been 30 years since 2012, but we were inducted into the Hall of Fame 2 years ago. And that team came together for the first time since that day, really, because we all scattered after the Olympics. And it was such a beautiful thing because we'd gone through hell together and we rebuilt ourselves together. And that's why we're athletes, because there's no joy like it and there's no pain like it. And if you're not an athlete, you don't really understand what that means. But it is a pretty special thing.
Mm-hmm. What did that work look like in order to get to that point of self-belief or team belief?
There's lots of different. The easy thing to describe is deciding to become the fittest team. And that meant when you were on your own, you were doing a lot of extra fitness. Mm-hmm. And that was easy to do because you had a real clarity of where you were going. So you just did it.
Yeah.
The harder part was probably the social part. I'm on record saying that one of the most challenging teammates I've ever had is Carmelina Moscato. Mm-hmm. And she and I played next to each other and we fought every day. Like our idea of how the game should be played was just fundamentally different. And we worked so hard on that relationship. And now we are on the phone with each other almost every day because we don't work together right now, but there's no one's opinion I value more because we've worked through it. I trust her that anything that she says is because she wants the best for me because we've worked through it. Mm-hmm. Like it's not when you can trust your teammates to tell you the truth and you trust that, then all of a sudden the communication is a whole other level because it's never petty. It's never, you never second guess what you're being told.
Yeah.
And that's a powerful thing. And that took a lot of really challenging conversation. It took a lot of, that mental performance piece that was just starting to really come into the game. It wasn't visualization, that sort of like imagine yourself scoring, which I just never connected with. I thought that's the most ridiculous thing. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
One guy made me like pretend I was in a canoe. I'm like, how is this helping? I was like half asleep when I'm on the floor. Instead, I worked on my breathing and my heart regulation. It was 5 minutes a day. You know, that it was such a simple thing. It was essentially meditation, which I didn't. It just give it a new, you know, gift wrapping, but it just gave me these moments of real calm and introspection that I needed. And all of us sort of found something, but it was really the key thing was how we spoke to one another. And really addressed when we got it wrong. And that led to some like serious smackdowns. Like right. That's huge fights, but my God, we were better for it.
What did those conversations look like and what were they often about?
Well, the most special relationship I had was with a player called Robin Gale, who played the same position I played. Mm-hmm. She's one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. And she was always able to take the fact that I started in front of her, like, and put that there and then tell me what I needed to do to be better. And I always thought like, that's when you know you've got a true teammate where their heart is breaking, because of course, every time the team came out, they wanted to be on that roster.
Totally.
But they'd put that for later or for their own time. And then when we were at training or pre-training or post or game, able to give you feedback, really specific feedback, because no one else knew it like someone in your same position. Mm-hmm. But it took like, there's this thing in sport that people want honest feedback. You know, like really honest, direct feedback, which is not true.
It's so true.
Not true.
So true that it's not true. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it really is like, it gives people the license to become an asshole. Mm-hmm. And no one needs that. And I think what we're learning is that as athletes, you need direct feedback, but it needs to be considered. Like, I'm not the same as you, I'm not the same as the next person. What does that person need? So like feedback without consideration is useless.
Yeah.
You can lose someone in a second because you've got the tone wrong, which you will do. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, we need to fix that. We need to address it. Like, I was in the moment, but you know, people, high performers, it doesn't give you a license to be a jerk.
Yeah.
And I think those that really like love yelling or like really like, come on, and they like give this like crazy feedback, they expect everyone to join them over there. Whereas the person who needs like arm around you, good effort, they expect everyone to join them over there. And if both these people at extremes are not making conscious efforts to try and meet in the middle, you're not going to have a functioning team because neither one of them is high performance. So it's really a balance, and it's also a real opportunity to learn how to receive feedback. We focus a lot on giving it and we do very little introspection on how to receive it. Mm. And then what to do if it's not right. Like, don't harbor it. Don't talk about it with someone else. It's triangulation. Don't bother. If you're a high performing team, you'll address the person and say, that's not what I need. And they'll say, well, that's how I give it. Like, well, I'm going to need you to reconsider, or you can absolutely do that once or twice in the game, but you'll lose me after that. So I just feel like you're screaming at me the whole time. And then I'm in my head. I that does not work for me. Wow. You know, these are the conversations that, you know, you're on a really highly functioning team when you can really get into the nitty gritty detail of what you need.
Mm-hmm. And so often would these conversations be happening obviously off the field, but the sort of interactions were happening on the field?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For sure. You don't need to be best friends with everyone who's on your team.
Yeah.
You do need to know what's going on in their lives. So when I say on the field, I think the high pressure intensity moments where maybe how feedback's given or received is being really done intensely.
Yeah.
But why that person is the way they are is because you need to understand them. Like, what is their story? What's going on in their life right now? Mm-hmm. How can you support them? And again, I'm not going to be best friends with everyone who's on my team. And as a coach, I do not expect everyone to be best friends. It's not going to happen, mm-hmm. but you need to have a level of respect for one another. Everyone there is trying to achieve the same goal, but also that personal, like, high performance moment. And if you can't do that, you won't play for me.
Right.
Character will trump talent. And I mean that very seriously. I've gotten into a lot of trouble for getting rid of real, really talented players. And in soccer, you call them mavericks, like people that can do something so differently than the group. I have space for one maverick on the team who doesn't conform. After that, it's too many players that are playing for themselves. And then, yeah, character wins out for sure. For me, every coach is different.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And what do those conversations look like for you as a coach? Like, do you address those people individually, or like when do you find that somebody is, what are the actions that they're doing that shows that they're not sort of doing the pursuit in light of the team rather than just themselves?
It's not a one thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. if people make mistakes, I think your words and actions have to align. And if they're not, then your character is in question. And if the team themselves are setting their values, their team behaviors and standards, and it should be the team setting that, then they're literally not living the words that they've had a seat at the table in creating. So it's important, I believe, for coaches to make sure that the athletes all have a say, and because that's what they're being held accountable for. Until those behaviors are really talked about and set in place, and you can't expect your athletes to be mind readers and to know what it is you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being a good person is a good starting point.
But then I guess it's also describing what defines a good person, right? It's like, I feel like I find in sports especially is that we need to, we like, I don't want to say dumb it down, but everything needs to be defined, you know? Like, I find like, even when you have technical calls, like I could be saying some sort of technical call and then somebody's thinking it's completely different, and it's having those conversations of, okay, what am I actually meaning? And I find those are happening so often. And I mean, you probably found that that was happening on your field all the time. Did you have that same sort of chemistry in 2016 as well?
Yeah, 2016 was really different. In a fantastic way. I was at the end of my career. And a lot of my 2012 teammates had retired. There was only, I think, 7 of us left from that 2012 team. And this huge cohort of youngsters had come up. And in 2015, we had a home World Cup, and we made a mistake. And that was, we didn't do a good enough job making them feel like it was their team. It was our team and they were on it. Whereas in 2016, I think, the greatest lesson I learned was a leadership one, which was if they had been on the team for 6 months, they were as deserving to be there as I was, who'd been there for 16 years.
Wow.
And that is, it's an ego at the door thing, because it's very easy. Well, on my day, we used to carry the balls. We used to carry our own boats. Like, I don't know. You know, you always do that. You look back and you do this, like, are they as deserving? Well, they won me that medal in 2016, those young players, it was their team. So they put the work in. As soon as they felt like it was their team, they really hit a whole new level. And these supreme athletes who were able to do things I could only dream of, and just incredible watching them. And my greatest moment in 2016 was I lost my starting position.
Oh, wow.
And but I honestly, I couldn't, it was for sure hard. But that player that took over, I hope, never felt like I was holding them responsible or there was a guilt piece. Instead, I was able to, I hope, again, I'm speaking for someone else, but almost be able to give them the green light to go take it. And honestly, they were so much better than I was. It was easy to do because I was like, wow, the speed, the pace, you know, the game of soccer has just taken off in terms of the professionalism now, the opportunity to be full time, the type of training you do. And yeah, so that 2016 team was that moment of real leadership and real accountability for that older generation to almost pass the mantle while still, you know, we lost in the semifinals. Mm-hmm. And we'd done it before. There's nothing like the experience of losing in a semifinals to be able to teach you what you should be doing. So I think the ability to bounce back from that loss was because of the leadership of the senior players. And we knew what to do. We needed to get them together. We needed to get them out of their beds. We needed to talk about it and then move on, which then gave them the energy to come back 2 days later and win that game against Brazil in Brazil for a second medal in 102 years. I don't think it's happened before, back-to-back medals. So pretty incredible stuff that I got to be witness
and a part of. Yeah, that's so exciting. It's so cool. I think that's very commendable on your part too, of being able to recognize that and realize, and I think it is really tough, like being an older athlete and seeing someone who's younger. But you're bang on with the whole ego thing. And like in the moment, it's, I think, cause there's probably so much emotion around it that it's so hard to see the outside perspective. And you just see like, oh, maybe this person's taking my spot or that sort of resentment, but actually being able to take a step back, a breath, and realize, okay, this is actually awesome because it means that our team is that much better. You know, like you see yourself as being a very high performer and this person just beat you.
There's no hiding. You're like, we're not saints. We're not martyrs. It's so painful, but it's not that person, you know, like they're doing their job and they're better than you on that day. So that pain is real. I don't think we can hide from that. It's really a challenging moment that you need to work through, and it takes a second, but you don't need to do that in front of the group. You don't need to do it in front of that player. That's a personal journey that will come to everyone.
yeah no, it's so true. Gosh, if I'm being 100% honest, I actually just experienced this a couple days ago where my roommate and I raced against each other and she beat me. And it was one of those things too, where, like we raced head on, and sitting there at the end and seeing that boat beat me, you just feel terrible and such loss and that sort of like embarrassment. And then it's not until afterwards that you can kind of reflect and realize, you know what, that was a pretty good race and kudos and also like how sick, like we were able to just push each other and have respect for each other and then move forward past that. And rowing's kind of funny that way too, like we have to be our biggest competitors as well as our biggest like teammates at the same time. And so it's like one day you're racing against someone for their spot or for your spot, and then the next day they're in your boat. And I think there's always that sort of side of it in different sports, but rowing is a little bit unique in that sense. And I can see that in soccer too, where like, yeah, there's going to be people who are starters and playing that position. And for yourself, like when you're on the field, how often do you get swapped? Like how often are you on the field when you were playing?
Do you mean like how many in soccer, how many subs are you allowed, or how often did I get pulled off?
How often did you get pulled off? Like, would you play the entirety of the game?
Yeah. You're only allowed 3 subs in a game.
Oh shit.
So there's 11 players. You don't sub the GK, the goalie, unless you have to. So there's 10. And then you always save one, because otherwise you have to play with a man down if you get an injury close to the end. So that's 2 people that can be replaced. So usually you're quite strategic about who need, because you might in a tournament, you've got other games coming up. So I played fullback. Mm-hmm. So the wingers tend to get subbed a little bit more. So I was fairly unsubbed for the majority of my career. By the end, my legs were going. So I was routinely taken off in the 65th minute, and I was more than happy to come off.
Oh man, nice. Yeah. Wow. So that's a long game.
We've got one player plays for Canada right now. She runs around 12 to 13 kilometers a game. Most people will run close to 10. Wow. So it's the sport. Like mm-hmm. I told you I rode the other day, and that full exertion and rowing, that lactic threshold you're hitting, unpleasant. So I'm just like, it's different kinds of pain in our athletic pursuits, but it's that one that's just it is what it is. You just, I guess with rowing, you just keep pulling and go through the pain barrier. And the same with soccer. It's a definitely a second wind piece where you've got to have the technical tactical ability, but mm-hmm. your endurance has got to be up there. Women and men run about the same amount in a game. It's very wow. similar because yeah. women have more space to cover usually.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's crazy. Because you're dealing with your competitors, like you're interacting with them. Whereas like for us, we're just racing. And so you could look at it as you don't actually have to think about your competitors at all. You're just focused on your race. But since you guys are actually interacting with your competitors, how often do you like study your competitors or like focus on what they're doing rather than on just your individual team performance?
You got to know who you're playing. And when you're an athlete, you've got to know who you're directly going to be going up against, or probably, because you don't mm-hmm. know who you're going to choose. But the studying of the opposition is a big part of the meetings, the preparation, what their tendencies are. It's a big thing, but most focus, depending on the coach, I believe mm-hmm. most of the focus should be on us, on the team. Mm-hmm. And then with you drip in who we're playing, the opposition, what we need to know about them. But some coaches spend a lot more time on the opposition and sort of react more. It's more of a coaching philosophy, I would say.
Right. Yeah. Okay. You said that you're just back here now for a couple of weeks. So what's yeah. your journey now for the next 4 months?
So I'm the assistant coach for England and for Team GB. So we're in the process of making an 18 player roster out of 4 countries. So Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England. 16 players means 2 goalkeepers. 18 players is 2 goalkeepers. So the 16 best players from 4 countries is a very thankless job and an impossible one. So we've been doing a lot of work on that. My days usually start at 4 a.m. because I'm on UK time. That's the time zone I work in, even though I'm in Canada for the next few weeks for family stuff. I'm fully working, doing meetings. And this is the beauty of the international game, because you've got big windows between camps where you're working and preparing, but you can actually, thanks to COVID, do that anywhere with Zoom and Teams and all the new technologies we have.
And so are these selection camps?
We've done them all. Oh, and by that, I mean the two of them, because COVID has made it impossible. All our athletes are playing on their club teams. So bringing them together is obviously a challenge during a pandemic.
Right.
So lots of testing, lots of protocols, which we need to be ready for, because that will be the Olympic experience. It'll be very different than anything we've gone through before. But as I've told the players, the medals are the same and the competition is the same. It's just maybe the atmosphere and the greatest lesson I learned. I was in Beijing, and before we went there, Marnie McBean, a rower, came and spoke to our team, and she said, "It's the Olympic competition for you guys. It's the Olympic Games for the spectator." And we were all like, okay, yeah, right. Like, sure, that's really easy to hear. But 2008, we spent a lot of time chasing Lionel Messi around the village, Kobe Bryant, like all these, Serena and Venus Williams, like just so in awe of the whole Olympic experience. Mm-hmm. And it was incredible, but it meant that we were out in the quarterfinals. Whereas if you look at 2012, 2016, for us, it was the Olympic competition. So for those athletes that are going there and they're worried that everything will be different, it will be, but the competition part is the same. Yeah. And that is what the Olympics are for you.
Yeah.
Like, you were never going to just go in the stands. You're not there as a spectator. So for the Japanese public, yes, this Olympics will suck because it was coming to their country and they were mm-hmm. going to be able to show it off. But for those on television and for those that are competing, it's the same thing. It's a competition.
Yeah, when you say that sort of the dynamics in the village was different between 2008 and 2012, what exactly did you guys do? Or was that an individual focus or an overall team focus? Whether that, was that conversations being had beforehand, or how was that dealt?
It was the first time Canadian soccer had made it to the Olympics. So none of us had had an Olympic experience before. Mm-hmm. So we thought we knew, but Beijing was out of this world. The amount of money, yeah. We won't get into sort of like the human rights stuff, but it was so vast, that Olympics. Wow. And, you know, we were sharing a building with these guys, these idols of ours who we'd just seen on TV. We're Canadian. We didn't have any opportunity to see these people in person. And all of a sudden they were like really right next to you. Wow. So we got really sucked into the whole story of the Olympics. So it was amazingly fun. I went to the aquatic center. I went to the, you know, I like took part in everything. Mm-hmm. And in some ways you know, I loved it, but we were not there to compete. If I look at it now, we were so all that I'm just telling you my story, but I'll tell you what, my teammates were worse than I was chasing people around because it was just so cool. Yeah. You know, but in 2012, we had a lot of new players there who hadn't experienced 2008, even more in 2016. But because we'd had the experience, we were able to really be their teammates and explain, like, you cannot do that. You can't, because you need to be resting. This is our competition. And after we're out or we've won that medal, you can go become a spectator. But until then, you've got to focus. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it only comes from experience. And that's a lesson that, you know, we learned in 2008, but you also don't want to take away the joy of it. It is such a cool thing. And there's a reason why people, you know, you get the tattoo and get the ring. It's something that you strive for your whole life, and I never thought I would achieve, and you know, it was and is a very special thing, but the athlete cannot forget that it's a competition for them. Mm-hmm. And the game is for the spectators. It's a big lesson.
When you say that you thought that you never would have achieved it, at what point did you start to realize, like, oh, this is happening?
Well, you know, Canadian soccer, we were expected to be in Athens and we got knocked out and it was unexpected and my dream was gone. I'd always wanted to be an Olympian. Mm-hmm. And we just didn't make it. And I was like, oh, there goes that Olympic opportunity. And I was like, what if I did bobsledding? I could be the third person in the bobsled, like doesn't drive, doesn't break. That's so disrespectful for bobsledders. I'm not saying I could have done it. I was like, my dream was gone. And then, you know, we qualified for Beijing and I was so happy to be there. As I said, like, it was just, I couldn't comprehend. And then 2012, like it was very gradual. It really was, I always had that fraudulent, you know, I felt like fraud all the time. I couldn't believe that I was there. How am I still here? Mm-hmm. How am I starting? Like, everything was a surprise. And you know, then you start learning that majority of athletes were not the best at their sport. They're the ones that had that drive to keep working hard, to keep finding a new level. Like you talking about your teammate pipping you at the line in a race, you're both be better for that experience. And if you aren't, then you're probably plateauing and that's, you're getting to the end of your career. But if you use those little nicks, those little cuts that you get along your career to drive you and push you further, you just keep hitting new levels. And that was, you know, I never thought I'd make the Olympics. 2004, my dream was gone. 2008, I became an Olympian. 2012, we won a medal. I never dreamt of winning a medal. It was so foreign to me. People don't understand. I say that they think I'm lying because we've won two now, but I never even thought of it. It was just so weird. And you know, I turned to some weird prayer before that game. Like I made weird deals in my head because it was so outlandish.
Wow.
You know? And then you win this medal and then you're like, well, yeah, okay, let's win another. And then your standards change as you experience your sport. And if you don't feel like a fraud a little bit, then you're probably not pushing yourself enough or pushing the levels enough. Because if you think you've made it, you're done.
That's interesting that you say that. So do you think, when you say fraud, I think of like imposter syndrome. Is that what kind of you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you think that's a good thing to have?
Yeah, a little bit. Mm. I don't think you should show it. I don't like sort of like groveling or in women's sport, the biggest thing, I think Abby Wambach said it, is you're fine if you're very thankful for being there. Mm. And not just sport, I mean the boardrooms. I mean,
yeah, gratitude.
Just there it is, gratitude. Be very grateful for being there. Thankful to everyone in the room for the opportunity. And that's, no, you've earned it. You've earned the right to be there. But that feeling of like, ooh, I hope, like the preparation, like making sure you take care of all the little details, making sure you understand your content if you're a coach, like making sure that you're doing everything you need to do in order to be in the room, and then you deserve to be there. Yeah. Do not be thankful like for being the lone woman being given the opportunity to be the lone woman in the room. Like, no, you should be there.
Yeah,
you deserve to be there. And it's the same as the athlete. Like, you've done the work. Mm-hmm. You haven't cut corner. If you're challenging to become an Olympian, you've done the work to be there. But yeah, you should have that little piece of you that's like, okay, where do I need to push and improve?
Right. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think there's a fine balance between that healthy sort of imposter syndrome that we talk about. And then also feeling like people getting to that certain spot, or like, I even saw in university, like when you talk about education and achieving certain academic goals, then they might be there and think, oh my gosh, I don't deserve this, or, you know, and I wonder where that actually comes from, because if you take a step back, you're like, oh no, you did all these things have lined up into this outcome now. So where is that sort of disconnect between you don't think that you deserve this and you're sitting there achieving this?
You tell me.
I don't know.
I mean, different for everyone, right?
Yeah.
It's a different level, and that's what you've got to work through, because mm-hmm. if you give one of those too much room to grow, you're in trouble. It's a healthy dose, probably. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think it's definitely individual, and it probably is happening over a long period of time too. And being able to take those moments to kind of sit back and reflect and realize, no, my work has led me to this spot, and that's why I'm here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably just one last question for your team right now, for GB. How long do they train together before you guys actually go and compete then?
Well, we're still, obviously with COVID, things are still up in the air. Mm-hmm. So even the season, the professional season in England has been really hard on the players. They've had a long season. So again, it's balancing all those four corners in terms of, we want them straight away, but how much rest do they need and have they earned? And yeah, so we're still kind of figuring that out. That's sort of what we're doing now, making the mm-hmm. team, figuring out the plan to make sure we're peaking for Tokyo.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a complex puzzle. Definitely. Very exciting though. Do you have any last words of wisdom for any athlete?
Yeah. Well, I guess one of my biggest things right now is remembering why you love your sport. And we're a little bit unfair on young people sometimes. We're like, we say, find your passion, mm-hmm. find the thing that gives you meaning. And then remembering that, I don't know about you, but I didn't fall in love with soccer on day one. I really enjoyed it. I also enjoyed hockey. I enjoyed ringette. I enjoyed running cross country. I enjoyed a lot of different things. And I was given the space and the ability to get more and more interested in things. So I went down different paths and I, you know, try different things and you fall into a passion through interest, through deep dives in interest. And that's what I would say to young athletes, and take away the professional part, take away even the high performance part. And it's more to parents, to give your kids the opportunity to fail and learn and love it. Because if they're going to go far in their sport, it's the hours they do away from training that count. Mm-hmm. Otherwise they're all doing the same thing. I my young athletes when I worked with them, I was like, if you're playing tag in the park as an 8-year-old, you're developing physical competencies that will help you in rowing, that will help you in rugby, that will help you in tennis, like strength, agility. It's being outside, it's being active in what you do. Then you take a ball out there, and even throwing a ball, you're learning depth perception, you're learning to time, how to jump, which is going to help you as an athlete head. It's getting, just allowing them to naturally become more and more interested in something. Mm-hmm. Failing at it is where passion grows. And we do put a ton of pressure on our young people in specialization and success, and air quotes again, success. Like, if your kid's not the best at 8, then you put them in something else so they can be better at that, so they can find their passion. It's like, just chill out.
Yeah.
Chill out and remember where you were when you were that age and the space you were given to grow and to find the thing that you loved. Because I definitely was not the best on my soccer team ever. I just loved it. I grew into loving it. And then I started doing, like, playing at the park with the ball with my brother, or put my sister in net. She's kind of useless, but it helped me much. You know, like, I mean, just give people space and remember where it comes from. And that's the joy and the love of sport and being active. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is, I'm speaking as a soccer player, but I'm actually just an advocate for physical activity and letting your kids find their thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's it, really.
Nice. No, I love it. And I totally agree. And I think it's actually quite interesting when I do have these conversations with athletes, especially athletes who have continued their sporting career for a long period of time. They're the ones that they did a lot of different sports and had different interests growing up. And it wasn't until, like, later, maybe like 16, 17 or whatever, where they're like, you know what? Yeah. Okay. Now I'm going to specialize, you know? And it's like taking in everything around you and appreciating, like you say, physical activity and everything that has its wonderful joys of doing that, then it plays into your sporting career later in life. So, yeah, great advice. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation and your time. And of course, I am on the Canadian team, and I can't imagine what, I mean, you have a job, and I'm guessing that's how you think of it when you're now coaching another country. This is your job, so you can probably dissociate different countries, is my guess. But I definitely wish you all the best in your coaching career, and I love seeing athletes transition into coaches who have that perspective, a broad perspective of what it takes to be a coach and what it takes to be an athlete, because I think those understanding those two fundamental things makes you a better coach. So it's really awesome to have this conversation with you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. Good luck to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rian. Your wisdom and fresh perspective is exactly what sport needs. I wish you all of the best, and I'm looking forward to following along in your future. Thank you to my systems engineer, Sydney Payne, Claire Briand for background music, and thank you to all of you for taking the time to tune in. Next podcast will air May 31st with the one and only Tessa Virtue. So stay tuned, everyone. Have a wonderful day and go get after it. Thank you.